Commission of Texas versus Polk Operating, cause number 0317-00080CV.
Good morning. May it please the court. There are five issues I'd like to discuss. Polk asked for the protective order in this case. Polk always linked production of documents with the protective order. The template that Polk set out with the agency was no production without an adequate protective order. Number three, ultimately, after working with opposing counsel, engaging in a discovery dispute before the examiner, and taking the interim appeal allowed by the Railroad Commission's rules, Polk ultimately prevailed. It got what it wanted. Four, arriving in district court, Polk claimed that the agency had committed an error that completely tainted the protective order and rendered it meaningless, and that the agency should be mandamused for not shifting the burden to the requesting party to demonstrate necessity for trade secret. And five, the whole necessity issue is not really how Rule 507 works. So those are my five topics that I have shoehorned into two issues, couched in administrative law language. One, a failure to exhaust administrative remedies. And I want to make an apology. I've already apologized to Mr. Finoglia. I want to apologize to the court. I overwrote in one aspect of that issue in my brief. They did list the production order in their appeal to the commissioners.
Well, you just gutted my first question.
I'm sorry. I mean, I felt real. They didn't use the full title, and it was crammed in a paragraph, and that's my only real excuse, except I felt I'd spend half of Sunday berating myself and thinking, I feel really stupid. It doesn't change the failure to exhaust argument. They did include it in their list, and they did use, in a very generic sentence, they did use the word reverse. So it's fair to say that the order itself was there, but the claim was not. At no point in this case did Polk Operating say the burden has to shift, we have to have a necessity hearing, Evergreen has to demonstrate necessity, and the examiner has to make a finding of necessity.
Is the problem that in the appeal to the commission they weren't specific enough in listing that trade secret was their real concern? You know, it seems like they focus on their objections that they had lodged and their relevance and everything else. I mean, are there magic words they had have used in that appeal to overcome the exhaustion issue?
That's not exactly it, Your Honor. That's generically, that's correct. But it isn't that they just incorporated generic objections. It's that they never made a necessity objection.
Where does the necessity fit in? Because as you point out, it's not specifically in 507. Is it an aspect of the trade secret? Couldn't necessity be one of the balancing factors in determining whether there's relevance for a production?
Yes, and we don't know. If you look at the ALJ's order in his two conclusions of law, 3 and 4, and they're in the record. Most of the specific things I want to talk about are in tab 6 to the appendix of my brief. And it's record, it's around page 202 to 203. There are two conclusions of law where the ALJ says this will balance the competing interests. And he uses the term relevant. He does not use the term necessity. And what Polk is arguing is that he had to make a necessity finding. But remember, he didn't make a trade secret finding either. This is a discovery dispute. And with most tribunals, you want the parties to work out their discovery differences between them and only have the tribunal weigh in on what it needs to. And so...
So by saying relevant, you're saying that they necessarily found in favor of necessity.
I don't think so. But it was never attacked. I mean, I think that you can look at that conclusion and see that he performed a balancing, but he didn't make a necessity finding and he didn't make a trade secret finding. He took them at their word. Polk said this is a trade secret, and Evergreen said we want it, and the ALJ said, okay. Polk said we need a protective order, and the ALJ said, okay. Polk said to the commissioners, the protective order that I wanted and the ALJ gave me isn't enough because I've realized I have a competitor in here and I need to ratchet up and use the federal form. And the commissioner said, okay. And then Polk went to district court claiming that he was entitled to mandamus for an abuse of a discretion we were never asked to exercise. It's sort of like the kick at the end of the Monty Python skit. We said yes to everything. We cannot be mandamused for abusing a discretion we weren't asked to exercise, but that's a merits issue. That's a merits question at the district court level. We're here on an interlocutory appeal of my inability to convince Judge Triana that someone who is the prevailing party is unable to take a regular administrative appeal or a mandamus. Mandamus is a good vehicle for a discovery dispute that you have lost.
Let me point out the only roadblock I see to that argument, and that is if you're going to say they got everything they want and prevailed, how do you get around the fact that when we look at what they actually appealed to the commission, included their basic objection to producing the documents at all?
Because their basic objection was to producing documents to their competitor. That was their objection. As they defined the discovery dispute, they won it. That protective order includes, in its qualifying person description, this cannot go. The competitor is named, and no past, current, or future employee of the competitor is allowed to receive those documents. They cannot be discussed in the hearing if anyone associated with Sprint Energy is there without a prior ruling. It's in the nature of an in limine motion, without a prior ruling from the examiner, and they are sealed. So that's why we say they won. They didn't oppose production completely. They opposed production to Sprint, and that's throughout the record. The first letter.
I just want to back up, though, before we get there. I mean, I know that was the thrust of their argument, but following up on what Chief Justice Rose said, if they've incorporated their objections to the actual production as well, they're not waiving the argument that we shouldn't have to produce this at all. I mean, protective orders are in almost every case in the civil context these days. I mean, if you're in federal court, it's almost automatic you're getting a protective order that does exactly what you're saying. So why would we say they got everything they want if they've still incorporated their objections to producing the documents at all?
Because their objection was not to producing documents at all. Their objection was to producing documents to Sprint.
Well, when you say that a question asks you something and you object that's irrelevant, how is that on a objection that you don't have to produce the document?
I don't believe that a relevance objection covers every possible discovery dispute, or we wouldn't have the specific invocation of the trade secret privilege and the demonstration of it. And the case law, even the case law that they rely on, the Continental Tire case and the Levington case, Justice Field, you say that protective orders are in almost every case, and that's right. But in almost every case, the party who proffered the agreed protective order and said this is what we need doesn't get to go appeal. You don't see case after case in Southwestern Reporter in which that happens. You're right.
Do we want to discourage people from being realistic once an objection has been essentially overruled and keep them from entering into agreements with a protective order? I mean, what you seem to say is they should have been louder and longer in objecting to the production, but instead, because they only put that down on paper, and moved on to the protective order, that they somehow waived their substantive.
Yes, yes. In the Continental case, the court, the Supreme Court is discussing Jampol v. Tucci. And let me, I always bring too much to the podium, but let me just say that in distinguishing this, in Continental Tire, there were two batches of documents. There's what are referred to as the other documents, and those are documents in which there was an agreed protective order. And then there were the documents about the skim stock or whatever it is that goes on the tire. And one party argued, well, they've agreed, you know, they've got this protective order, so this goes in with that. And they said, no, the agreed protective order was just those other documents. And the court said, talking about Jampol and distinguishing Jampol, Jampol did not consider Rule 507's effect, presumably because the defendant acknowledged that any proprietary interest could be safeguarded by a protective order.
And again, so isn't that cart and horse? I mean, at that point, you're assuming that the defendant is acknowledging that they have to produce the documents. And as long as it's protected, they're okay with that. But I don't see anything in Jampol that's actually saying, if defendant, you disagree that these documents should be produced at all, that by entering a protective order, you're waiving the right to complain about that.
In a situation like that, yes. But this isn't that situation. They came in from the very beginning and said to opposing counsel first in the letter that's in the reporter's record at Exhibit 1, I think we can work together. At the hearing before the examiner, they said, the protective order we've suggested, the agency, and remember, Justice Field, they are not saying that production, their argument in mandamus and district court is not about production. It is about the examiner not shifting the burden and making a determination of necessity.
Why would that burden have to be shifted?
Well, according to Polk, that's how Rule 507 works.
To entitle the requester to production, you have to show necessity.
Yes, they say that's how it works, but that isn't how it works. There's no mention of necessity in 507.
My point in raising that with you is, let's just put aside whether that's how it works or not. If that's the argument, though, if the argument is the burden should have shifted to show necessity, isn't that, as a matter of course, an argument that we don't have to produce it unless they show necessity?
No, Your Honor, because they did not phrase their objection in that way. And as discovery works, and as the case law indicates, when you're in a discovery dispute and you acknowledge that a protective order can protect your proprietary information, that whole preliminary threshold question of shifting the burden and necessity is not in play. And as footnote 2 in the Leventon case that they rely on, I'm trying to make sure I have rely on, says, tribunals don't call halftime and say, you've convinced me on the trade secret, now we're shifting the burden, you convince me on necessity. You have the hearing, you take everything in, you consider what they've said to you, and you make a decision.
Once that tribunal orders the production, though, don't we assume that they made all the findings necessary? And so wouldn't you presume that if a necessity finding is necessary in the course of that, that's implied into the order?
Well, yes, and that's my secondary argument, Your Honor. If you look at conclusions of law 3 and 4, of the ALJ's order, and I do believe it's 202-203 of the record, of the reporter's record, then you've got a weighing of the competing interests and a determination. There's a generic use of the term that they are within the scope of discovery. That's in conclusion of law 3, and necessity could be implied in there. But let me say that at no point did they become that specific. And looking at this record, I have no reason to think that if they had told my client they needed that too, that the client would not have convened a necessity hearing and done it. I believe that I am now in my rebuttal time, so I'll step away unless there are more questions.
Thank you, Ms. Secord. I'm sure you sounded very nice on the recording, so don't worry. Let's see how Mr. Finoglio
I didn't said. Think it would make me as nervous as it did.
We got to keep things interesting around here.
Please don't go to video before.
We can't afford it, luckily.
May it please the court.
Good morning, sir.
Chief Justice, Justices Goodwin and Field. You're absolutely right on Rule 507 and the Continental Tire case, the Leviton case, and Cooper Tire, a Waco Court of Appeals case, all say that when you raise the burden that this is a trade secret, and it was raised in the discovery requests, or our objections, which are part of the appeal to the commission and to the district court, the burden automatically shifts. That's jurisprudence since 1999. The requesting party has to show necessity. The record is devoid of any attempt, much less successful showing, of necessity of trade secrets. They wanted Polk's entire file, effectively, including the price it charges its customers, who its customers are, the process by which they engage in this recycling process to turn oil and gas waste into basically soil. The record is clear that Evergreen was prompted by by my client's primary competitor, Sprint. In fact, Sprint's president, CEO, and vice president are identified throughout the hearing as expert witnesses for Evergreen. And Evergreen wanted to bring those two individuals on my client's property to inspect the procedures by which they accomplish turning waste into dirt. For whatever reason, the lawyer for Evergreen, I guess it never occurred to him to know what the jurisprudence of the state. I thought it was clear. I think it's been clear since 1999 with the Supreme Court handing down. If you can show a trade secret, and we did, we have an affidavit on file, it was never challenged, then the burden shifts to the other party to show I have to have this pricing information in order to determine whether the pits are overfilled or whether the stormwater protection system is adequate. Maybe the lawyer knew what the standard was and didn't want to try to connect the dot between I need to know what price you charge your customers who bring material onto this site as to how that relates to my need to determine whether the pit is overfilled or the stormwater protection system does or doesn't work.
Where do we have a ruling on that issue in the administrative record? And where do we have proof that the commissioners actually considered that in their ruling?
That's my point. They never did. They recognized, because the commission order that council discussed references a trade secret, 202 or 203 of the record. So the commissioners are recognizing it's a trade secret. But there's no evidence that anyone weighed the burden and said it's necessary for the requesting party to have this clear trade secret information.
Was it incumbent upon your client at that point then to either request a ruling or object to the fact that that wasn't made?
Well, unfortunately, the way the commission rule works, 1.16 Text Admin Code 1.30 C and D, there is no motion for rehearing. There's no process. It is final. And if you think about it from an agency perspective, they need it to be final so the proceeding can go on. But we couldn't, there was no procedure by which we can tell the commissioners sitting in an open meeting, you've made a mistake and fix it. So,
does the necessity issue go to the merits of what would be before the district court in the face of the denial of the plea? I'm just trying to figure out how it all fits together based on where you are procedurally.
And I'm sorry, Judge, does the necessity...
This necessity issue of yours, how does it fit in with the fact that basically what we're here on is the Railroad Commission's appeal of the denial of depleted jurisdiction?
Well, and it's important, Your Honor, that the commission hasn't objected or appealed the court's temporary injunction, which is on the merits. Their only objection is to jurisdiction, which we believe is inappropriate in a situation like this. They need to get the merits up squarely before you.
And that necessity finding, though, isn't it wrapped up in the merits?
It is wrapped up. I mean, that's what the judge found in the trial court. There was no necessity shown. That's the basis underpinning for her decision to issue the temporary injunction. By the way, and the quick solution would have been for the commission to go back. The proceeding, and by the way, the proceeding is over. We started on December 15 of 16, and we ended May 12 of 17. So the proceeding at the Railroad Commission is over. In this framework, in December and January is when the commission made its decision, and we took the appeal to district court.
So is there a separate appeal of the commission's final ruling from the proceeding, or is it wrapped up in this?
This is an interim appeal of the commission order requiring my client to disclose trade secret information and allowing our competitor to be on our property. Those are the two issues we appealed while the case was winding its way through the commission. Did that answer your question, Judge?
Well, I'm just trying to figure out what we have left if your commission proceeding is over and resolved.
I request the right to file a brief on mootness. I think it is moot while we're here today.
Well, if it's moot, I wish somebody would tell us. So, sure, you can file whatever brief you want, and the Supreme Court can respond accordingly.
And again, Judge, thank you. We don't think the plea to the jurisdiction is appropriate instrument to defend the erroneous discovery request. There is no rule unlike the APA, Administrative Procedure Act, there's no rule or statute for the commission that prescribes a certain form of discovery objection for an interlocutory appeal to the commission. Texas Rule of Evidence 507 is the linchpin of a protective order and trade secret. And again, the Continental Tire, the Leviton and Cooper Tire, and Rubber 313 3rd, Southwest 3rd, 910, 915. Once a party has made a showing of a trade secret, the burden shifts to the party to prove necessity. We don't have to prove the negative. It's the party that's seeking the discovery that has to prove necessity. Absolutely no attempt to do so. And the commission order doesn't address it either at the ALJ or at the commissioner level.
What's the scope of the temporary injunction that the trial court issued? Is it solely related to the production of documents? And tell me about that in light of the fact that your commission proceeding is now ended.
There were two reasons we appealed. One had to do with the production. We also objected relevance. Judge didn't go there, but we objected on the basis of you're requiring us to produce our trade secrets without a showing of necessity, and your order allowing Brad Dugas, who's a vice president for Sprint, and Mr. Swinbank, who's the president's CEO, to come onto our property to do some sort of inspection of our process. And so those are the only two issues that we took up on appeal to district court.
And the TI says what?
And I'm sorry?
The TI just basically says...
The injunction says to the commission, you're enjoined. Nothing in here prohibits you from going back and having that showing. And I read that as an open invitation. If you'll give me just a moment, Your Honor, I'll find it in the record. I read that as an open invitation. I thought for sure we would be back in front of the commissioners on that matter.
To make a showing of necessity?
Well, that the requesting party would have to show necessity.
Well, at this point, with the commission proceeding over, is anybody even asking your client to produce the documents or taking any action in the matter?
There was a request for sanctions in the hearing in that request, but and to answer your question, there's no pending discovery order from the commission saying you must produce the records. The commission has upheld or respected the ruling of the district court.
And the final order of the commission is settled, or is it on some sort of appeal now?
The way we've tried it is 6 or 7 day trial. The way the process works, there's a proposal for a decision that has to be issued, that parties have the right to file exceptions and replies. Then it goes to the commissioners themselves for a final order. And so we've tried the case. The last day was May 17 or May 12 of 17, there it sits.
You don't have a final order?
We do not have a final order. We don't have a proposal for a decision, which would be the basis for which you can finally issue a final order.
Right.
And it's in the record. I'll as to the district court's order.
This case might present a great CLA opportunity to talk about using the term in the alternative when asserting these type of things. Well, before you move on to the protective order, in the alternative.
Sure. one hopes that one learns every time one tries a case, and
I didn't mean it as any criticism.
In hindsight, I should have shouted louder about the trade secret and pointed out what I thought was clear to everyone, that when you've satisfied the first burden of showing it's a trade secret, oh, by the way, the other side has to show necessity. I thought that was clear from the get-go, but some people seem to think I need to educate them on what the jurisprudence is. Thank you, Your Honor. I'll yield back. I see I have some time to yield back.
Good. I'm sure that's appreciated.
Upset you.
Thank you, Mr. Pinoglia. Rebuttal, Ms. Secord?
Pleading in the alternative is certainly a great idea, Justice Rose. Can I sign you up for to give that, write that paper and give that talk?
But my New Year's resolution was not to agree to those offers. So.
Absolutely. I was going to say no to all future requests.
Although, you know, a good use of our recording equipment would be for you all to declare that the case is moot, then our recording would have been a great investment.
Well, counsel and I disagree about the definition of over.
Is there still a pending order or opportunity for them to have to produce these documents that seem to be an
issue?
Yes.
Now, the evidentiary hearing, the initial evidentiary hearing was completed last May, but there is no proposal for decision as I understand it, and I checked in with them last week because sometimes there is a failure. It's almost always my fault when there's a failure to communicate, but every once in a while the client doesn't tell me something, and I checked in with them. The proposal for decision has not yet been produced, and there is, of course, because of that, there is no final order of the commission. My reading of the injunction, and I do not have it before me, my reading of the injunction is that the Railroad Commission has been enjoined from enforcing those two discovery orders unless they hold a necessity hearing and make the necessity finding. Now, we did not appeal that. That is a narrow injunction limited to the facts of this case. This is a discovery fight between two parties before us as the tribunal. And if I'm right that there is no jurisdiction, you have no standing to complain about a discretion exercised in your favor, that injunction will go away. So we didn't make a big deal of it and bring it here because the important thing is this whole question of, when you say this is how Rule 507 works, don't you have to tell us that? And the answer is yes, you do. Mr. Fanolio says that he shouldn't have to educate some people on the case law. And he said at the district court hearing. The agency has 30 lawyers. They should have known this. Well, Continental Tire doesn't say what Mr. Finoglio says that it says. Continental Tire says when you acknowledge that a protective order will give your proprietary information the protection that it needs, then the necessity finding is not in play. In Continental Tire and in Leventon, there had not been that acknowledgement by the party. The parties in this case shifted immediately to Rule 507C, which talks about protective order. It is okay in discovery disputes for people to work it out and say, as long as my competitor doesn't get it, as long as there's a logbook kept, as long as counsel is accountable for the non-competitors who get it, as long as it's sealed, as long as it's not presented in the hearing with my competitor present, that's an adequate protective order. So 507 doesn't work the way they say that it works. And and my secondary argument, which you have brought up a couple of times, Judge Rose, is Leventon indicates, you know, this is nuanced. It's going on in the mind of the judge. And the judge spit out two conclusions of law that were never challenged. The opportunity to do that was at the appeal to the commission. Mr. Finoglio says, and he's correct, there's no motion for rehearing process in a discovery dispute, but that's because your interim appeal to the commissioners is the functional equivalent of your motion for rehearing of the examiner's decision, and they took advantage of that. This fits into the motion for rehearing cases that are in my brief, in which this court, in Hill, in Burke, in all of those motion for rehearing cases, discuss that you have to be sufficiently clear in your motion for rehearing about what your claim of error is. And it is jurisdictional over the claim. So the whole impression left in Mr. Finoglio's brief that the plea to the jurisdiction might not have been well-founded as really a jurisdictional matter, it is. That's the exhaustion question. And that it works that way for you all. Someone who has not adequately made an objection and preserved error to a district court, your appellate jurisdiction does not attach over that claim. It might attach over other things in the case, but not that claim. I'm at zero.
Let me ask you a question before you sit down. Just going back to the mootness argument he made, if we were to rule in favor of the commission, as a practical matter, what effect does that have on the proceeding as it goes forward?
I think the commission has the ability, if this court rules as I want and the entire cause sitting before Judge Triana is dismissed for lack of jurisdiction, the injunction will go away. They can enforce those discovery orders. I think they have the power and authority to reopen the record. I don't know if they will, and I have drawn a pretty bright line with that because my job is to advise them to obey the injunction and then proceed, as long as they're obeying the injunction, proceed in due course, but they do have that power. I don't know whether it would be an uphill climb for Evergreen because they went ahead with the initial evidentiary hearing without those documents. That's up to the examiner.
They somehow got through it without those documents.
You know, I would expect there'd be an argument that that no big deal now, but I would expect Evergreen, from what I've seen in the record, to want them, but I don't know that, and we can't know that. But the most important thing is, oh my goodness, we gave them everything they told us they wanted. And here we are still.
Here we are still. Ms. Secord, Mr. Finoglio, thank you both for a fine argument. The case will be submitted in the full standing recess. See, you survived your first audio recording. Thank you.